You know when your customers are shopping at your business and they pick up a product? The customer holds it, feels it, and shows it to their friend. Then they look at the price tag.
Oh my, I need to look at something else.
The customer picks up a second item and loves the way it looks. They've heard of this product, but haven't yet seen it in person.
I've got to have this!
You're happy the customer chose to buy a product, but you're equally frustrated that they didn't buy both items.
I want them both.
The Consumer Experience Lab at Barbera Solutions designs behavioral strategies that target the consumer's decision-making process. BarberaSolutions.com. Because the opposite of rational is not irrational. B-A-R-B-E-R-A Solutions.com. Why is the shopping cart always in the top right of the screen?
How do companies predict my purchases?
Why do prices end in 9?
Why do fast food companies use red and yellow in their logos?
Why do restaurants always have one expensive menu item?
Researchers, marketers, and very curious people seek the answers for how we make decisions and how we choose products. ClickSuasion finds the secrets that companies use and shares them with you.
Why do I feel better when I bought the last remaining airline ticket?
How do I make choices based on colors and fonts?
Welcome to ClickSuasion. This is your host, Michael Barbera. We're here with today's guest, Dr. Jane. Dr. Jane is recently a graduate in the PhD of Marketing from the University of Iowa. And his dissertation is titled The Hitchhiker's Guide to Numerical Space of Anchors, Landmarks, and Adjustment. Dr. Jane is the winner of the Ballard and Seashore Dissertation Proposal Award, and his research interests include numerical cognition, how it impacts consumer judgment and decision-making. Additionally, how computational limitations such as attention and working memory capacity bias consumer evaluations and decisions while using human eye tracking, facial expression analysis, and other psychophysical methods to investigate research questions in addition to traditional experiments. Dr. Jane, welcome to the show. How are you?
Thank you, Michael. How are you?
I'm great.
Thanks for inviting me to the show.
Thanks for being here. So I know you and I spoke earlier, and I'm going to ask you for the rest of the audience, how does it feel to be a recent graduate of a doctoral program?
Well, it feels pretty good, although, you know, on most of the things, it will still take some time to sink in. But to begin with, calling me Dr. Jane has made me feel very, very different. My first name is Gaurav.
Well, we like to give credit where credit is due.
Well, thank you.
So let me ask you, what is so fascinating about anchoring that made you want to pursue not only a PhD, but a career in the subject?
Well, you know, if I ask you, do you think that Gandhi died at the age of 60? And then if I ask your alter ego whether he thinks that Gandhi died at the age of 90? And then I ask both of you, at what age do you think Gandhi actually died? Chances are your answer will be closer to 60 and your alter ego's answer will be closer to 90. And this bias in your judgment due to the very first piece of information that you were exposed to without your own willingness, this very bias, you know, is fascinating. It's been used in marketing for a very long time, in pricing. It's been used in marketing on your logos while people tell you about the percentage of fat in a particular beef and all over. But every time it has been used in marketing, it has been used in numbers. It has always been numerical anchoring. So what fascinated me was when we have the common cortical matrix for numbers or for any other kind of many other modalities, why can't we go ahead and use anchoring in other domains as well, such as domains of haptics, domains of sounds, or domains of colors? Can I anchor you using a particular sound before you walk into my store? Or can I anchor you to a particular shade of gray or a particular shade of brown before you walk into a Louis Vuitton showroom or, for that matter, any kind of showroom? So that fascinated me.
What are some examples of color anchoring that you could share with us?
So in the lab setting, I had to go with a very, very controlled experiment. So what I did in my lab, I called the participants in, showed them a particular, and ask them about that, what they think is the right color of the moon. And everybody knows that there's different perceptions about the shade of the moon depending on the time of the day and what light settings are there around you. And then I showed them a gray scale. There were 26 shades of gray, and no puns intended. They were actual shades of gray starting from exact white to exact black. And then I asked them what they think is the right shade of moon, depending on what they had answered before or what shade, particular shade they had seen before. So I anchored them beforehand. And then I tracked their eyes and saw that they were always, their responses were always going towards the shade they were anchored with. So that was in the lab setting. But if we go in the corporate setting, think of a Louis Vuitton showroom. They generally have about 3 to 4 main colors, and three of them are on the darker side, on the brown side. And wherever whenever you think of a Louis Vuitton showroom, you think of other brands as well. So now if we think about Gucci, now Gucci has many, many colors. Their colors range from across all the, their colors range from different, from all the colors, from light to dark. So if I were a Louis Vuitton marketing manager, I would try to anchor my customers the moment they walk into the store towards the brownish side, towards the darker side, so that they start perceiving the colors of my 75% of my bags. I mean, that's not an actual number, but 3 of their 4 main colors are towards the darker side. So if the consumers are anchored to begin with towards the darker side, they'll be more likely to choose or have positive attitudes towards the bags that Louis Vuitton is trying to sell them.
So when should we expect that Louis Vuitton is going to send you their offer letter?
No, that will still take some time, because first of all, there have to be a lot of ethical issues that Louis Vuitton have to go through. And we always have to fill a form known as IRB. Once they get through that, they will be sending me the offer letter, I guess.
So I really like how you brought that up. What are some ethical concerns that come up with marketing and anchoring?
So the biggest question I always get is that I'm always with the devil. I'm always trying the marketeers sell their product to the consumers. Now, I don't completely believe that, first of all, because a lot of my projects, like in one of my projects where I'm working with framing, how we frame the marketing communications, I actually show that it can be more beneficial for the public sector companies to use more specific numbers, such as 81.56% instead of about 80%, to actually make the smokers perceive smoking to be much more injurious. So one is that yes, I'm not always working on the devil's side. Second, the devil is not the devil. What is making this economy run? The marketeers, I believe, have the responsibility to tap into the consumer surplus, that is, for making the consumer spend and feel happy and making the money run in the economy. If the marketeers are not there, nobody will be going and spending their money, spending $2,000 on a particular computer and for a particular brand. So when marketeers create brand, they tap into the consumer surplus, which is, I think, is very, very important for running the economy.
Now, how does human eye tracking correlate with anchoring and research?
So human eye tracking, so anchoring is a phenomenon and framing is a phenomenon. All these biases are biases which we see as phenomenon. And anchoring is eye tracking is a methodology. It is a methodology to tap the processes underlying these phenomenons. So I use eye tracking in my experiments to actually look at the underlying mechanisms of anchoring, which, by the way, are under conflict in the past literature. There has been 40 or 50 years of literature on anchoring, and still there's nobody is very sure about how anchoring takes place. So I would answer that question by saying that eye tracking is actually a methodology that can be used for many, many purposes. I use eye tracking to look at the underlying mechanisms of anchoring.
So a lot of our listeners are practitioners and a lot are also researchers. Mm-hmm. For the practitioners who are listening, we might be talking some foreign language to them. So what are some findings or uses of human eye tracking for research that can't be attained from traditional research methods?
Okay, so to begin with, first of all, in anchoring, there are two schools of thought that, which are very, very prominent in the literature. First is the thought of insufficient adjustment, which was initially proposed by Tversky and Kahneman themselves, which were, and Kahneman is a Nobel Prize winner and a father of behavioral economics, both Tversky and Kahneman in that regard. So they said that when we are exposed to the anchor, we actually move towards our response in, you know, they didn't say steps, but they said that we move. And that movement is effortful. And once we get tired cognitively, we actually stop moving. And that's why we are biased towards the anchor. On the other hand, the proponents of selective accessibility have proposed that, you know, they don't recognize any kind of movement. They say that their mechanism is more about positive hypothesis testing. To make it very, very simple to our listeners, I would say that once people are exposed to the anchor, for example, I asked you in the beginning, do you think that Gandhi died at the age of 90? What you will do, you will engage in positive hypothesis testing. That is, you will bring to mind all the information unconsciously. You will bring to mind all the information that is consistent with Gandhi being aged 90 when he died. And then you will construct an answer. You will not move. You will construct an answer. And that answer will be constructed based on the information that is already there in your mind. And that is already biased by the anchor. So these two mechanisms are very different. There are a lot of conflict. And my dissertation tries to distinguish between these two mechanisms and to point out the nuances about these two proposed mechanisms and what can be the exact mechanism. So theoretically, that is very, very, very useful. Practically, the importance is once we tap into the mechanisms of any kind of phenomenon, we come across a different kind of phenomenon itself. Once we tear out a layer of why, we are exposed to a new layer of what. For instance, in this case, when I started looking at the underlying mechanisms of anchoring, I figured out that people actually move from their response and they move in steps. Now they don't stop at all the points in that continuum. They stop at particular points in the continuum, and those points are just like landmarks. And the exact same thing I propose happens on numerical anchoring as well. So when I give you an anchor known as when I give you an anchor of 90 for Gandhi's age when he died, which actually is a wrong answer, okay, it's just an anchor. So if I give you 90 as the anchor, you will actually move towards the answer. But you will, while moving, you will land on particular numbers. And what I call them as numerical landmarks, which is the second essay of my dissertation. So the practical implications of numerical landmarks is plenty, and I would like to talk about that in this podcast. And so I think that's from there we'll have more and more practical implications due to eye tracking.
Your dissertation is titled The Hitchhiker's Guide to Numerical Space of Anchors, Landmarks, and Adjustments. Mm-hmm. It's recently been defended, obviously. We all know that already. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Tell us a little more about your hypotheses, your RQ, what the findings were and how practitioners can use that.
So like in essay one, I hypothesize that people that anchoring will take place in non-numerical domains as well, and people will actually make steps towards the final answer after being biased by the anchor. And the big thing comes over here that I propose that we have numerical landmarks on the mental representation of the number line in our brain. So all of us have it has been shown in the past research that we have a mental representation of the number line in our mind. Okay, what I find over here is that number line has numerical landmarks, and that's the term that I have given myself to these particular numbers. So what are these numerical landmarks? These numerical landmarks are just like physical landmarks. Now, what are physical landmarks? I am currently sitting in Albany, New York, and when I first came to Albany, my mind was making a mental map of Albany while driving, and there were certain points around me in the physical space which stood out from other points. And in the mental representation of this map, I coded the properties of that particular space. It can be an old church or it can be a big building. So, and then I code the details of this particular physical landmark in my mind, and that's how physical space works. What I show in my dissertation is that we do the same with numerical landmarks. There are certain numbers which stand out in our mind. Now, that can be because of the properties of the numerical space itself, You know, think about numbers like 30, 40, 50, 60. They are the ending of the last decade. They stand out from the last decade. Think of a number of 100. It is different from the past 99 numbers. So yes, rounded numbers do act like physical numerical landmarks, but that's not it. It can be my birthday, my birth month, last two digits of my social security. Those can be numerical landmarks. So what am I doing in my dissertation? Am I just renaming the rounded numbers and some significant numbers as numerical landmarks? Well, no. What I'm showing is, and here's where it gets interesting, that these numerical landmarks share properties with physical landmarks. Now, physical landmarks have certain properties that have been shown in the past literature, which are that they are stored in our memory in way more detail. They can be recalled way more easily. So they are very salient and accessible in our mind. And third, most importantly, physical landmarks act like decision nodes. So, you know, if I am climbing Mount Everest from the south side, so probably while I'm climbing Mount Everest and I'm very exhausted, I would probably like to camp somewhere. And I will not choose any point to put a camp. I will make a decision on a seemingly distinct looking physical landform, like starting off an ice sheet or starting off a steep slope, something like that. And it happens in the numerical space as well. So when we think of making a decision, which I show using eye tracking in my research, we often make a decision on these landmarks. So that becomes very, very significant in the practical use. For instance, suppose I'm just thinking off my head. So suppose I am a Toyota marketeer and I am trying to make a new engine and I want to do a focus group interview. And while doing that focus group interview, I have to be very, very careful about the numbers. And if I ask them a question that, you know, our last engine used to give 28 miles per gallon, but this particular engine can probably give 45 miles per gallon. What do you think is the miles per gallon you will be happy with? How much should we stress before rolling out this engine in the market? Before I give the points on that particular scale that I'll be giving the participants, I have to be very careful because depending on those points, whether those points are 5, 10, 15, 20, 25, 30, or they are like 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, and so on, my responses from the focus group participants will be biased. So that can be one of the practical implications of numerical landmarks. The other thing can be in packaging. When we are using packaging for certain products, whether I am giving a number 80 on the packaging versus I'm giving a number 78 on the packaging makes a huge difference about how much do I remember about all the other details on that packaging. So that can be a practical implication as well.
So to your knowledge, which products or companies are currently using these tactics in their marketing?
Well, I would refrain from using any particular names, but yes, there are many FMCG, fast-moving consumer goods, and consumer goods companies which sell products ranging from which sell products that we use in our daily lives. They are using these properties while selling. They are using our biases while selling toothpastes to us, or while selling cans to us. And whether they are doing it, whether they have in-house research for doing that, or whether they are doing it unknowingly, that's a different question altogether. But once we know more about it, we will be very, very, it will be very, very helpful to help the companies to better streamline their research and to help the policymakers as well to save the consumer from any kind of unethical practices that the companies might be following.
Agree. We always want to make sure that we're providing or offering the best possible ethics, or we're designing our marketing campaigns with the best possible ethics in mind to create a good user experience. I really like how you mentioned toothpaste, because when it comes to my own grocery stores, anchoring and biases are very popular in marketing and sales and product placement within grocery stores. And you can imagine yourself sitting in front of that or standing in front of that, the aisle at the grocery store with toothpaste. And there's probably a couple of hundred options to choose from. But which one do you choose from? Are you anchored? Is it lived experience, or is it a personal bias? Why you buy a specific toothpaste brand?
Absolutely.
So I actually want to ask you a few questions about yourself. Let's learn about you. What are some anchoring techniques that nudged you into a decision?
Well, there might be many. The first of them is in pricing, because researching on cognitive biases does not make me immune to cognitive biases. So I think the first of all is pricing. When I'm looking for houses over here right now, because I'm moving in the area, and the first price is generally given by the producer, and that's what biases the consumers a lot, including me. If I want to decrease the price, I'll start from that price which has been given by the dealer to me. And so pricing is coming to my mind. That's the first thing. The second thing that is coming to my mind is smells. Smells. We can use anchoring in smells as well. So the moment I walk in a particular restaurant, if there's a strong aura of a particular dish, I'll be anchored towards that particular dish. So all my other dishes that I'll be calling for will have a contrast effect due to that anchor. And my own preferences will be biased due to that anchor.
I'm guilty of that too. I'm pretty sure I've been anchored into food many more times than I was supposed to be just because of the smell of the food.
Yep. Yep. It happens to everyone, believe me.
So guilty of it. who would you say were some influential researchers that, whether you know them or not, really guided you through your path and your education?
I think the research by Tversky and Kahneman into behavioral economics, their flagship paper, and that really inspired me, made me look into this anchoring and judgment and decision making. And all of behavioral economics. The other researchers that I would name probably are Dilip Soman from University of Toronto. His work really seems very, very interesting. And I think works of Jonah Berger and Dan Ariely. These are theirs were the works and books that I had started reading during my undergrad when I started thinking about behavioral economics.
Yeah, I'm sure we're going to see a lot more of you soon now that you're starting at RPI as a professor in marketing. What would you say to individuals that are looking to start a career in behavioral economics or behavioral finance?
Well, the first thing probably I would like to tell all the people who are listening to me and who are thinking of starting a career in behavioral economics or behavioral finance is to figure out what exactly in behavioral finance and behavioral economics you are interested in. Because this field, behavioral economics, behavioral finance, is on a continuum. It starts from, on one end, it has deep psychology in it. The theories are deeply rooted in psychology. On the other hand, it has theories from economics, deeply rooted in economics. So what kind of researcher do you want to be? Do you want to be a judgment and decision-making researcher? Within the realms of behavioral economics, and you want to look at the psychological processes, you want to start with psychological theories, or do you want to be more on the economic side? That is, you want to work on more of economic theories, you want to make mathematical models, how the mathematical models differs due to our own biases. So that's the first thing you need to think about. You want to be more of an experimental researcher, or you want to be more of a quantitative researcher. And depending on that, one needs to start in the field.
What is next for you? What's next? What's going to happen in the next 5 to 10 years for you? What's your plan?
So I will be looking at sensory anchoring. That is how anchoring can impact humans in non-numerical domains. And I will be looking at other biases as well, like framing. How using 81.26% lean beef is actually considered to be more fatty than 80% lean beef. So that's a project I'm working on. I'll be looking at these kind of biases for the next 5 years, I see. After that, I'll be working with grad students at RPI, and I'll be setting up my own lab where we'll be that's a long-term plan, where I'll be helping companies, as small companies, not big companies, small companies, to use behavioral economics and the cognitive biases in their marketing practices in an ethical way.
So I'm sure that a lot of our listeners would love to get in contact with you and talk more about behavioral marketing, consumer behavior, research, etc. How could our listeners get in contact with you?
Oh, I'll be very happy to be in touch with our listeners. And I think the best way to reach me is my email, which is gaurav-jain@uiowa.edu. It gets directed to my new email. I'll spell it for you if you want. It's gaurav-jain@uiowa.edu.
Well, thanks so much. I think I'll email you too.
Oh, great. You're always welcome, Michael.
Having you as a guest. Very insightful. Congratulations again on completing your dissertation. A very proud feat you should be very proud of.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.
For our listeners, go ahead and subscribe to the podcast wherever you get your podcasts from, and we will let you know when the next episode is available. Till then, this is Michael Barbera. Have a good day.
Thanks for listening to ClickSuasion. Subscribe to the podcast, read our research, and get in touch with us at clicksuasion.com. You can also find us on Twitter with the handle @ClickSuasion.
Are you tired of being confused and frustrated by your business books? Do you want to do your own business bookkeeping but don't know where to begin? I can help. My name is Crystal Wombeck, and I am a certified bookkeeper. I'm the creator of the Simple Bookkeeping Program. This online, work-at-your-own-pace video course will take you from confused to confident when it comes to your business books. Log into accountingbycrystal.com and sign up today.